From KUAZ News in Tucson, I'm Julie Buroc, and this is Arizona Spotlight. A small Hohokam farming village in the Tucson-Marana area is the site of an active archaeological dig. KUAZ's Bill Mortimer visited the area and has a feature report on what they're discovering. According to a new book, Tucson is one of the top 50 gay-friendly places to live. We'll speak with the author. And KUAZ's Nelson Warnell visits a venerable downtown Tucson Christmas display. Also, the commentary of Baxter Black. Those stories and more are coming up. But first, a Hohokam agricultural village has been discovered in Tucson. KUAZ's Bill Mortimer has the story.
The town of Marana is currently holding a public-assisted excavation and research program at the Yuma Wash site, a Hohokam residential settlement. There have been very few Hohokam classic period sites investigated in the Tucson Basin. This archaeological dig is led by project director, archaeologist Courtney Rose of the Old Pueblo Archaeology Center.
This site was first discovered in 1982 by the Arizona State Museum when they were doing a walking survey for the Northern Tucson Basin Survey. But since then, in the past 20 years or so, a number of archaeological testing projects have been conducted here by many different archaeological companies in the area. Old Pueblo got involved a few years ago and also did a testing project in this area because the town of Marana wanted to develop it. The site is actually quite large, and it extends on the southeastern side of Silver Bell. Right now we're on the northwestern side of Silver Bell excavating.
It's obviously the perfect opportunity to begin to understand the Hohokam of the Tucson Basin. How did you become involved?
The town of Marana decided to partner with the Old Pueblo Archaeology Center and develop the district park here. And Old Pueblo Archaeology Center's work is going to be incorporated into the park. So there's the Guille Bohorquez Ranch site, which is nearby also. And this site that you're on right now is called the Yuma Wash site, which is a classic period Hohokam site that dates to between 1100 and 1450 AD.
Well, that goes back a ways. You might say we're digging up memories here, because that's exactly what we're doing. And what discoveries have we made so far?
Well, right now we're in our third year of excavation, and we only have about 17 days a year, so that's very little to excavate, but we excavate very slowly, and we incorporate the public in the excavation process. So today we are finishing up the excavation of a Hohokam pit house, and we seem to be finding a Ramada structure outside the pit house. So we're moving outside the pit house and looking for the rest of it.
We've said that this is a public-assisted dig, and there are several volunteers here today. Arma Marino is a retired school teacher.
I am retired, but does not mean I don't stop working or learning. I've been out here about 3 days, and for this year, and it's been exciting. I like to hang out with archaeologists and geologists because you can really learn from them. You can learn some things from books, but really it's the people that really open doors.
And now this is really a hands-on for you.
I'm a hands-on person. As a teacher, I always had stuff for the kids to handle because that's a good way to learn. And when I talk to kids, I still go into classrooms and visit. And when I go there, I want to make sure that I know what I'm talking about. So when you go on a dig, you get dirty.
Now, have you found anything in particular?
We have found, of course, a lot of pottery, broken pottery. But I did find a pendant. It's a stone that is carved. And you can see it's people made. And that was very exciting. We have found shell fragments and some beads. So all this is work that the people have done. But I'm sure that all that is traded, because we don't find, isn't that correct? We don't find some of these materials, shells, for instance. So we know we were trading. Mm-hmm. And I say we, I'm a fourth generation Tucsonan, and I see these people as my ancestors.
Based on archaeological studies of the Hohokam of southern Arizona, the classic period was a time of societal transition, as evidenced by new styles of architecture, shifts in settlement patterns, and use of the environment. Courtney, you told me earlier that it's thought that this was a farming community.
This was probably a farming community, and we do have evidence of some canals and a water reservoir on this site, and they were probably farming maize, and they may have been trading for agave. They used agave here because we found agave knives, so we know that they were using agave. And it was probably a small village, not as big as the Miranda Mound, which is a little farther north of here. Maybe only 100 people at a time, at any given time, lived here, but it was occupied for a couple hundred years at least.
Sam Greenleaf is a board member of the Old Pueblo Archaeology Center. I've been told that you've made a few discoveries yourself.
Yesterday we found what looked like a feather pendant made out of stone, which nobody has seen out here before, so it was real interesting. A lot of shell, some beads, a lot of chip stones, some arrowheads, a lot of tools. So there's a lot of things here. It's a very rich site.
Are you an archaeologist yourself? Or?
Actually, no, I'm a building engineer. Okay, but this is what I do for fun.
You found some buildings here.
You betcha. It's always interesting to try and understand how they made a living here 2,000 years ago. It's a tough environment, but they lived here and they had no problem with it. And it's just fun recreating what they made. I do flint knapping, make stone tools, arrowheads, other scrapers, other tools. And it's just interesting to see how they made a living.
This dig is also an opportunity for students of archaeology to get some first-hand experience at such an important site as this Yuma Wash. Here are a couple of students from Pima Community College.
Lindsay Cole and
Robert Baker.
Robert Baker. So what drew you out? Are you taking courses in archaeology at Pima?
Yes, and my master's is going to be in archaeology, so I thought why not have some hands-on experience. So.
Well, they've put you to work.
Yes, and it's quite fun, I must tell you. I love it.
Have you discovered anything, Robert?
I found some points and some shell beads. I was here last fall as well, and then I've been out here for several days this fall.
We mentioned these societal changes and new styles of architecture. Tell me about that, Courtney.
We are hoping to find different types of architecture here, and we have found it. We've found Pueblo-like room blocks, above-ground room blocks enclosed by compound walls that are basically surface structures. And here we found semi-subterranean houses, which are these pit houses, the Hohokam pit houses. So we were finding different architectural styles, and we're hoping to get some good dates on when these houses were occupied, and that'll give us a good idea on if the Pueblo room block structures were occupied later than the pit houses, or were they all occupied at the same time. That'll give us a good idea.
Let's talk to this gentleman who is using a screen to sift through the dirt. Your name is?
My name is Paul Virgin. I'm a volunteer. Recently retired to Tucson and wanted to join this group for a long time. I've been visiting here for a long time, and I joined a month ago, and this is my 15th day on this dig, and I've learned volumes of things. I started out with the basic work, and now they have me doing what I consider important, you know, kind of the things where things are really being found, and they've let me try every possible part of the process, so I've really learned a lot. And what we've been working on the last couple days is some type of a pit in the pit house. It could have been a storage space, it could have been a burial. We've come to the bottom of it and really discovered nothing. And so you go through the process, you don't know what you're going to find, and try to figure out, you know, how it was used.
Well, I notice there is a difference in the texture of the earth here on what would be the floor, I guess.
Yes. What we pulled out of there were adobe balls, lumps of adobe that they would use for construction of the floor and also the inside of the pit.
What these people have done back when times were a lot harder than we can even imagine.
Yeah. And the craftsmanship of some of the pieces that we've found, especially the jewelry pieces, that they're astounding. They're so small and fine, and the tools they were using were stones. And they were cutting shells and drilling holes and making these very beautiful objects that, for something that happened hundreds and hundreds of years ago.
Right, and someone said a moment ago that they had found something that didn't really look like it belonged to these people. So obviously there was some trade going on between these people and who knows who else.
Right, yeah, all the shells, of course, came from California, and so there was definitely trade going on there. And the pottery that we're finding here, not all of it is made here, so a lot of it came from northern Arizona and was traded for perhaps something else, something that they had here that was wanted there. Mm-hmm. And so the interchange went on.
There are many other workers here, mostly volunteer, but some are paid archaeologists overseeing this very important Hohokam site. Thank you, Courtney Rose, for your hospitality and everyone involved. When will the digging resume?
Start up again in February, the public site, so if anyone wants to sign up, they can call Old Pueblo Archaeology Center.
Well, that's right. You do look for volunteers.
Yes, we do. Just call us up, and we can sign you up to dig.
From the Yuma Wash site on Tucson's northwest side, I'm Bill Mortimer for Arizona Spotlight.
Stay tuned to Arizona Spotlight. Up next, KUAZ's Nelson Wornell visits a venerable downtown Tucson Christmas display with traditional music performed by Ruben Romero and Alice Gomez. You're listening to Arizona Spotlight on KUAZ. Tucson Museum of Art's El Nacimiento display has long been a tradition in the Old Pueblo. Recently, KUAZ's Nelson Wornell visited the downtown exhibit.
An enduring Tucson holiday tradition is the El Nacimiento display at the Tucson Museum of Art's La Casa Cordova. Maria Luisa Tenya and two young assistants create the elaborate nativity scene with hundreds of painted figurines made mostly of terracotta. Museum Director of Public Relations Meredith Hayes says downtown Tucson is a fitting location for El Nacimiento.
Casa Cordova is definitely a cornerstone of the historic block here. It is one of the oldest structures in Tucson. It's believed to be the oldest structure. It's on the National Historic Registration. And it really does represent the roots of Tucson and its Mexican influence when it was still a part of Mexico. A lot of the structure that you see was built roughly about 1850. It is part of the first known map of Tucson that was created in 1862 showed the Casa Cordova was there. So they're estimating about 1850. It's a wonderful space to have it in because with El Nacimiento, it really shows the Mexican culture and being in such a culturally significant building really adds to it.
Edith Garcia spends countless hours helping construct the intricate arrangement that combines the symbolism of the Spanish colonial Catholic Church with the simplicity and faith of everyday existence in rural Mexico.
I like it, you know what, because I am Mexican, and I love all this one, because we are the United States, but you have the little spice for Mexico, and I think everybody's looking the Nacimiento and say, wow, it's a lot of work, And how do you go up and come down? And it's looking, when the children is coming, it was, this year is so curious. The girl is coming and tell her, oh, daddy, can you take all these toys in my garage? And I said, sorry, you can take nothing. If you see the children's face, it's like surprise, wow, how do you make that? And because we have a lot of angels, the little animals like bunnies, chips, little dogs, and always say, can I take one? And you know, the rocks is different, colors, signs, and everything is beautiful.
The beautiful holiday vision is a labor of love for Maria Luisa Tenia.
The tradition started in my house since I was a little one. But I brought to Tucson the tradition in 1978 because my mother kept her tradition in Guadalajara, and she passed away in the 78. And I already belong to the Casa Córdoba, to the Padrinos of La Casa Córdoba. And when my mother passed away, she made her nativity until the last year, and we have the, you know, the Rosca de Reyes and every dinner is. And when I came back, I talked to my group about the, what happened with my mother and the tradition and everything, and they say, why you don't bring this tradition? Because it's, we in Tucson, they didn't have it too much, because only in the windows they put the little the Virgin, Saint Joseph, and sometimes the three wise men, and that's it. And I said, well, if you agree and everybody agrees, and since then I start making it since 78. This is the 28th the time that I built it. The first year was very, very hard because I didn't find the figurines. I have to go to Guadalajara and got some figurines, and little we start with a small one, and later on it's been growing a little bit, and every time that I come down to Guadalajara, to Tlaquepaque, to Tonalá, I always bring some figurines from there, or my sister, or my nieces and nephews, and everybody knows that I'm crazy about the nativity. And they bring me some pieces. One time somebody was making an interview, and when it's done, a couple came in, and then, and when they saw the nativity, they were crying. And they said, you know, even we are not Catholics, but we are thinking that this is something that where the baby Jesus really is.
You can view El Nacimiento at the TMA Casa Córdoba during regular museum hours all the way through the end of March. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Nelson Warnell.
Up next on Arizona Spotlight, we'll speak with author Gregory Compass about why he's named Tucson one of the top 50 gay-friendly places to live in his new book. This is Arizona Spotlight on KUAZ. Joining me now is Gregory Compass. He's the author of the new book, 50 Fabulous Gay-Friendly Places to Live. Gregory, thanks for speaking with us.
It's so great to be here with you, Julie.
First, let me ask, what made you want to write a book about outlining the most gay-friendly cities in the United States?
I think there are a lot more gay-friendly places in America than people realize. Some people think the only places to go once you decide or realize that you're gay is San Francisco or New York or Chicago or Dallas. And there are a lot more options than that. So I wanted to create a book that would give people some idea and some options of where else they could go.
And what have you found are some of the features of a gay-friendly community? What must a city have to be considered gay-friendly?
I think one of the biggest requirements would be having a community center or some sort of a community support system for the gay community that lives in that city or place. That's probably one of the most important starting places. Next would be businesses that are gay-owned or gay-operated or catering to the gay community. And politics, having a political, local political system that encourages their gay community and supports their gay community.
In reading the book, it seems you have a lot of information in this book about the different places. I mean, you have vehicle registration fees and everything. It's very much a resource guide. How long did it take you to compile all this information?
The research and writing was very quick, actually. I did it in about 4 months.
So wow.
It was a very fast turn time. Some very long days during that time, though.
And I imagine there's a lot of travel involved as well.
Unfortunately, I didn't get to do much travel during the research period because the turn time was so fast for the writing. But I did travel for almost 10 years as a musician. So I got to see almost all the country and in the process, most of the cities in my book.
Well, let's talk about Tucson. You've named it one of the 50 gay-friendliest places to live. Can you explain for me why you've included Tucson on your list?
Well, the residents of Tucson's gay community asked me to include them. I had, during the early research period, I had an online form and people could fill out why they thought their city should be included in the book. And members of Tucson, a lot of members of Tucson's gay community, emailed me and told me what a great place it was. And because of that, I extended my research and learned more about the city. So it was really the local residents who were responsible for the city being included in the book.
So organizations like Wingspan, they actually asked you to put Tucson on the list?
Yeah, they asked. Yes, it was Wingspan actually that came to me and said, you need to look at our city and consider it for the book.
And what were some of the reasons they included in that statement?
That the local community is so open to the gay community and their gay residents, the art scene, the casualness of the city. One of the other things that turned me on as I was doing my research was the new economy and the importance that's being placed on high-tech jobs and the arts and the creative fields that are also very prominent in the Tucson area.
And you've also included Phoenix on your list. Can you tell me a little bit about that city and how it compares to Tucson?
Well, you know, every city has a different feel and a different style. One of the things I liked about Phoenix is that it's so spread out and that the gay community is integrated throughout the community. There's no central gay ghetto, if you will. The gay community is very large, and there's a lot of support services spread out throughout the community. It has a little bit different feel than Tucson, though. Tucson has that has a small-town comfort feel. Phoenix is growing into a big city, so the energy is very different in the two places.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Gregory.
Thank you, Julie.
50 Fabulous Gay-Friendly Places to Live is available online at fabcities.com or at Antigone Books on 4th Avenue. And here's KUAZ's Mark McLemore with the Arizona Spotlight Arts Calendar.
Tonight at 8 o'clock, catch an exhibition of experimental films, including found footage, animation, hand-painted films, digital manipulation, and more. Cinema 86, a night of forbidden cinema at the AME Auditorium, the corner of Mountain and Speedway. Holiday chorale music from the Renaissance through the 21st century featured with an eclectic Christmas at the Benedictine Monastery. That's at 800 North Country Club tonight at 7:30. Tucson Parks and Recreation Community Theater presents the Tucson premiere of Jacob Marley's Christmas Carol. It's at the Performing Arts Building at Randolph Center at 200 South Alvernon Way, and that will be throughout the weekend at 7:30. Also, the Tucson Theater Ensemble begins a production of The Servant of Two Masters by Carlo Goldani. This will be tonight and tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Temple of Music and Art.
It's now time for the commentary of cowboy poet and humorist Baxter Black. This one's called Rudolph's Night Off. Baxter says when it ran on Morning Edition in 1990, it got the biggest reception he'd ever had.
'Twas the night before Christmas, and Rudolph was lame. The vet from the North Pole said, "Foot rot's to blame. I'll give him some sulfa. It's the best I can do. But stall rest is needed the next week or two." "Great Scott!" cried old Santy. He turned with a jerk. "I won't get through pier if my headlight don't work. On Interstate 40 I'll surely get fined, and lost in Montana if I'm flying blind. No cop in his right mind would give any clout to a geezer who claimed that his reindeer went out." So he gathered the others, Old Honor and Blitzen. Were there any among 'em whose nose was transmitting? They grunted and strained, and sure made a mess. But no noses glowed brightly or ears luminesced. "It's bad luck in bunches," cried Sandy distressed. "We'll fly Continental, the Red Eye Express. I'll just check the schedule." He put on his glasses when up stepped old Billy, the goat from Lamb Passes. He shivered and shook like a mouse on the ark, but his horns were a beacon. They glowed in the dark. Santy went crazy. He asked, "Why?" with a smile. "I disabled a watch with a radium dial. Where I come from in Texas, we don't have thick hide. My skin is so thin it shines through from inside." "If that's true, then let's feed him," cried Santy with glee. "Gather everything burning and bring it to me." So Billy ate flash bulbs and solar collectors, electrical eels and road sign reflectors, firecracker sparklers, a ladyship shaver and lifesavers, all of them wintergreen flavor, and jelly from phosphorescent fish, day-glow pizza in a glittering dish, fireflies and candles and stuff that ignites, then had him a big bowl of northering lights. He danced on the rug and petted the cat. And after he'd finished and done all of that, to store up the static electricity better, they forced him to eat two balloons and a sweater. Then he opened his mouth. Light fell on the floor, like the fridge light comes on when you open the door. His Halloween smile couldn't be better drawn when he burped accidentally. His high beams kicked on. "Hitch him up," cried old Santy, and they went on their way. And I remember that Christmas to this very day. The sky was ablaze with a star shining bright. They were shooting and falling all through the night. And I realize now, though my fingers are crossed, what I really was seeing was old Billy's exhaust.
Arizona Spotlight is a production of KUAZ Radio from the University of Arizona and is produced in the KUAZ studios by Jim Blackwood, with production assistance from Ginger Duran. Our executive producer is Peter Michaels. A portion of the music heard on today's program was written and performed by Calexico. I'm Julie Burock.